From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, we check in on the women of Egypt. A year ago, they stood shoulder to shoulder with the men in Tahrir Square, hoping for change and women's rights. They're still waiting. Also this week, the Zimmerman verdict. We take a look at trials on TV with Marcia Clark, who rose to fame in another much-watched court case, O.J. Simpson. Then...
totally worth it.
The delicious taste of the trendy cronut. Too bad you can't have a taste over the airwaves. Also, the low, lonesome notes of Dawn Gibson.
Living my life on the other side of love, feeling like I can't unwind a memory of myself.
That's all on this episode of the podcast, so enjoy. In Egypt, the nation's caretaker, Prime Minister Hazem al-Bablawi, is rushing to put together a cabinet following the military ouster of the elected president nearly 2 weeks ago. But this political maneuvering is happening in a nation which is deeply polarized, and Egyptians have been voicing their opinions in the streets. The last 2 weeks have seen many rallies from both sides, those who want the now-deposed president, Mohamed Morsi, reinstated, and those who supported his removal. NPR's Leila Fadel joins us now from Cairo. Thank you for being with us, Leila.
Thank you.
Leila, Mohamed Morsi is still being detained, as we know. Has he been charged with anything yet?
Well, at this point, he's been in detention for almost 2 weeks with no charges. And now we're seeing that investigations are being opened, trying to find a charge, I guess, it seems, to charge him with. Things that vary from espionage to sharing state secrets with foreign governments to inciting violence. A lot of human rights groups say some of these charges actually seem to be a way to just keep him in detention.
What about his party, the Muslim Brotherhood? Have they given any indication that they're willing to negotiate with this interim caretaker government?
No, at this point, they say they feel this is a usurper government, that this was an elected president that was ousted by the military. They are saying that they will continue in the streets. What we saw last night was them spreading their sit-in that was centered around one mosque in Cairo to different parts of Cairo.
Leila, President Morsi was only in office for a year, and I understand that there is talk of a conspiracy behind his ouster.
Well, in Egypt, things are always very unclear. When you talk to Muslim Brotherhood leaders today, they say they feel that this bureaucracy that belonged to the old regime, 7 million strong, sabotaged the president at every moment. They point to things like the fact that there are no longer power cuts suddenly and shorter gas lines after a diesel shortage for months. They say they feel that this is evidence that actually this was a state that was against them and would never allow him to rule, and that the military had planned this. Others say that really this was the military answering to the people's demands after millions of people went to the street on June 30th.
Yeah. And Leila, finally, the street protests, they've been going on for nearly 2 weeks. You've been on them. Bring us up to date. Is there any sign of them diminishing?
Well, we have seen that on the side of the people who are in support of the military ouster, those protests have been smaller in the later days. I think it's very clear that this military coup is going to stay in place, while the Muslim Brotherhood leadership is really trying to mobilize all its people on the street, busing them into Cairo, trying to show that they have support among people, that they will not leave the streets. Some say it's a way to really disrupt the capital as the caretaker prime minister is trying to put together a cabinet as quickly as possible and move Egypt forward during a deeply polarized time.
NPR's Leila Fadel in Cairo. Thank you, Leila.
Thank you.
As Egyptians struggle over the future of their country, the issue of how women will participate has once again come to the fore. Even as women have been hugely visible as protesters, their rights have been less visible and in some ways regressed. Violence against women has also been a feature of the recent protests. To gain perspective on what's happened since 2011, we spoke to a young activist who's been at the front line for women and civil rights.
My name is Dalia Zieda. I'm 31 years old. I work as executive director of Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies. I believe that Egypt deserves to be a democratic state, and this is my main fight.
Dalia Zieda came by those attitudes through her personal experience.
I was raised to a very traditional family. My mother is a teacher and my father is an army officer. So he was absent most of the time. He died in a young age. So mostly I was brought up by my mother.
Ziada says her first protest was at age 8 against her family on the issue of genital mutilation. Her activism later gained momentum in 2006 when she was introduced to the legacy of Martin Luther King. By 2011, she was among the millions of Egyptians calling for the ouster of former President Hosni Mubarak. I asked her to remind us of the involvement of women during that time.
2011 was just another scene of glory for the Egyptian women. We did not only participate in the protests, but even in the making for the protest. I remember in so many days during the revolution, especially in the last days when people started to give up, the women were the ones who were motivating the men to remain in the street.
After Hosni Mubarak was deposed, what did you think would happen in terms of women's rights? What were your hopes?
During the 18 days of the revolution, we got the impression that the world will be perfect. Because during those 18 days, we were side by side with men, we were sharing everything with them. No one harassed us, no one told us you are a man or a woman. They were just working with us as Egyptians, fellow Egyptians. Then we saw that things will continue this way. But soon after that, while women went out to the streets making a march, a million women march, saying that we are equal, please consider us in the process of democracy and we need to be decision makers with you. They were faced by other men, actually the same men in the same square, in the same place, just telling them, go back to your home, it's not your time now. It was shocking to everyone.
In what specific ways have we seen the dialing back, would you say, of women's rights?
What happened later on is that first we had the military rule. It remained for about a year and a half. And the people who were in the regime then, they actually did not know that women should be involved as an essential part of it. They asked it to hold the elections. They made several decision-making committees and so on, but women were not involved at all. Even in the elections when they said we will give a quota for women, they said they will give a quota only on the list, but not in the parliament itself. So actually we were faced by a big problem. I ran for parliament in 2011. I was running for a political party that I co-founded with other revolutionaries after the 2011 revolution. And because of the bad perception of women in our society, I couldn't win. I didn't win.
You know, when you ran for parliament, you put out a survey asking people about whether or not it would be good for Egypt to have a female president. And the answer was 100% no. Do you think it would still be like that if you were to do that survey again?
Actually, I think we will still have a very high percentage that would say no, we don't want a woman president, we want a male president first. But it would not be 100% again, because the experience we had with fellow men within those 2 years, going through all these challenges together and actually insisting to fight back any oppressions that may be put on women, I think this has showed that we are very determined to continue our fight till the very end.
With Morsi no longer in power, what can we hope and expect, you think, for women's rights in Egypt in the future?
There is a lot of promising steps that has been taken by the interim president, Adli Mansour, so far, that actually tells me that the upcoming days are going to be good days for women. One of them is that in the constitutional declaration that was announced 2 days ago, there is a specific quota for women participation in every decision-making step that should be taking place. On another level, now one of the two big blocks that were in our way has gone away, which is political Islam. The big job that we should be focusing on right now is working on changing the mentalities of the grassroots people so we get rid of the patriarchal perception of women's rights in Egypt, and thus from there the reform will start.
That's Dalia Zaida, women's rights activist and executive director of the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies. From the start of the Egyptian protests in 2011, women rallied alongside men in Cairo's Tahrir Square. But the energy and confusion of the crowds have masked a significant danger for those female protesters: sexual harassment and assault. A growing number of organizations are responding to the dangers. One of those is HarassMap, a website which documents reports of harassment and assault submitted by victims via mobile phones and social media. Founder Rebecca Chow started the site, and she's been paying close attention to the growing numbers of assaults.
in this last week, received about 186 reports. The first day was 9, and then on the 30th, I think it was 46, and then 25, and then it changed day by day. But the bigger the crowds, the more assaults.
In April of this year, the United Nations released a study showing that over 99% of Egyptian women reported being the victim of some form of sexual harassment. But women's rights activist Saraya Bagat says attacks during protests are different.
It's sometimes not really clear to people, so a distinction needs to be made between the everyday sexual harassment that Egyptian women go through and the sexual assaults in Tahrir. What we've seen in Tahrir is like an animal that you knew gone rogue, gone vicious, and, you know, starting to bite. It's a far more vicious thing than regular sexual harassment. It's assault, it's rape, it's violence.
Anne Chow says the attacks in Tahrir Square aren't just acts of random violence. There's a political motivation to them.
Out of every mob attack, you know, there's maybe 100 or more men attacking one woman, and maybe 5 or 10 of these people are paid thugs who are organized and are paid to, you know, generate these attacks.
Though attacks continue to happen, Chow says the organization's efforts have meant that at least talking about sexual assault is no longer taboo.
When I started working on the issue of sexual harassment, it was 2005, and you couldn't even say the words. People didn't know what it meant, and even if they knew what it meant, they wouldn't admit that it happened or happened to them or anyone that they know.
But now, with public awareness increasing, both Chow and Bagat are optimistic that things could change.
The battle against sexual harassment and assaults in Egypt is also a mental battle. It starts with trying to change perceptions of society at large, and luckily, there are many groups that are working to really fight this and alter the perception and end the social acceptability of any form of harassment or violation of women. So that personally gives me hope.
As Egypt struggles with what a new government will look like, it is vital, Bagat says, that it remain committed to ending violence against its women. The issues at play in the Zimmerman trial, guns, race, and even social class, almost compel us to watch.
The trial of George Zimmerman, another dramatic day in court.
It's become such a closely watched, very highly charged court trial.
The jury is now deciding the fate of Zimmerman, who's on trial for the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Throughout, cameras in the courtroom have turned the trial into something of a must-see event for daytime TV. But is this a good thing? For some insight on how the spotlight changes things in the courtroom, we're joined by Marcia Clark. She knows a thing or two about the so-called trials of the century. She was the lead prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Marcia Clark is an author now, and she joins us from our studios at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So, Marcia, the judges decide whether or not to allow cameras in their courtrooms. When you first heard that the O.J. Simpson trial was going to be televised, were you pleased or were you concerned?
Concerned. We couldn't oppose it. It's the judge's determination. It's his decision to make. And it's also the extension of the right to a public trial. Part of the right to a public trial is the right of the public to know what's going on in a courtroom and to hold all of the parties accountable. Even though you can be, and I was, concerned about the impact right from the start, it seemed as though it was something that had a nobler purpose.
What's the biggest difference, would you say, as you prepare your case when you realize that a trial is going to be broadcast?
It doesn't really change the way you prepare a case. What you worry about more is the impact on witnesses and on jurors. The spotlight created by these kind of high-profile cases can induce certain people to come forward who are not really witnesses but want the spotlight, what I call faux witnesses. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it can also dissuade people who are legitimate witnesses but don't want the spotlight, and it may cause them to minimize whatever they have to offer in terms of evidence and testimony because they want to back away from the case. Can't tell you how many people tried to do that with me in the Simpson case and wanted no part of it. So you have to weed through those, and it becomes a very thorny problem. In addition, there's no question in my mind lawyers behave differently, mm-hmm. and judges behave differently.
How so?
When there's a camera. Well, you know, lawyers tend to perform for the camera, especially, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but the defense attorneys in general, this obviously gives them a lot of face time and it gives them a lot of notoriety and they get business as a result of it. And then you have judges. Some really enjoy the spotlight, some pander to it, some do not. I have to say the Trayvon Martin case is a great example of a judge who doesn't pander to the spotlight. So she's an example of how a judge can handle it very well.
I'd like to go back to the pressure on witnesses. I'm thinking of this young woman who was a friend of Trayvon Martin, Rachel Jontel. She was so highly and unmercifully, I thought, scrutinized.
It's so interesting to hear after the fact people's responses to things. I watched all of her testimony. And she was clearly very unhappy about being there. She didn't want any part of this case. That came through loud and clear. But she came across to me as eminently credible. She didn't necessarily try to paint Trayvon Martin as an angel, as Mr. Perfection. She quoted some of his statements that don't make him look good, but were nevertheless had the ring of truth.
So when we take a look at these, I mean, do you expect that this trend, I guess it is a trend, will continue, or is it up to judges in various jurisdictions around the country, and maybe many of them take a look at this and think, that's not how I want to run my courtroom?
Jackie, I thought after the Simpson trial was so crazy, it was such a bizarro world, I really thought judges around the country would say no cameras in the courtroom, and it didn't happen in case after case. Once again, we have cameras in the courtroom, and it's now become its own reality show, which is why networks, cable networks in particular, have gavel-to-gavel coverage of it as a matter of course, and they're waiting for the next new thing. As we speak now about Trayvon Martin, the case has just gone to the jury. The producers are actively, I promise you, looking for the next case to focus on because there's a public appetite for it, and I don't think it's going away.
Marcia Clark, she was the lead prosecutor during the O.J. Simpson trial and is the author of Killer Ambition, a new novel based on her legal experience. Marcia Clark, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Been a real pleasure. Thank you, Jackie.
Dominique Ansel only makes about 300 kronas a day. Some customers camp out overnight to get their hands on one, and some leave disappointed. The Cronut always sells out. Still, on a recent hot morning, the sidewalks of New York City hosted hopeful and intrepid customers from far and wide.
We actually heard it on the radio in Sydney, Australia.
From my wife, actually. She saw it on German TV, and then we are by chance here in a hotel nearby, and we saw the line, and then we decided to queue up.
I'm on vacation from Montreal. I read about it, so I want to try it.
Lee Hetch, Amir Borenstein, and Jeff LaPlante.
This is our third attempt of lining up here. And we thought, well, we're on holidays, we're here for a month, so we'll give it a go. The last thing we do before we go home.
So what is this thing?
Something that has a donut shape. It's flaky, like a croissant. That's why it's called a cronut. It's somewhere between a croissant and a donut.
That's the mastermind behind it, Dominique Ansel, chef owner of the Dominique Ansel Bakery.
I worked on a recipe for about 2 months before coming up with a recipe that could fry up easily, with a dough that could be filled with cream and glaze and still have nice consistency and not being too chewy or too soft.
Obviously a winning formula. It sounds good, but a lot of pastries are good. There's got to be more to the cronut craze. I asked Irma Zandel about it. She's an expert on consumer behavior and trends.
There's parts of the brain that become super active when a fad idea is heard and people want to pass it on.
Allison Carruth is author of the new book, Global Appetites, American Power and the Literature in Food. She says you can trace food trends back to the Renaissance when chocolate and spices took off. In a way, it's not complicated. We like things that taste good.
We need to indulge. There is a kind of fundamental and even primal impulse in the human brain for food to also be pleasurable and to be communal and shared and delicious.
But a big difference between the Renaissance and today? technology.
One of the things that we've seen with the advent of all these blogs and social media is that people's desire to be tapped in and to be perceived to be somebody who's in the know is much greater.
The food blog Grub Street wrote about the cronut when Dominique Ansel first made just a couple dozen. He says that same day, they told him traffic went up 300% with more than 140,000 links to their website. And it was then Ansel knew he had a hit. And those long lines, turns out, it's all part of it.
It's all about the experience. You have to come wait in line, get excited. You can smell the sugar coming out of the bakery.
That's Megan Bird. But for those who can't make it to New York City and smell that sugar, imitations have sprung up all over. Ansel has trademarked the name Cronut, but in Washington, D.C., you can buy a doisson. In Vancouver, a frisson. And in the Philippines, Dunkin' Donuts has introduced the donut croissant. A Dunkin' Donuts spokesman says they don't have any plans to sell it in the United States at this time. But is the media glare and all the copycats overkill, setting up the cronut for a collapse? Allison Carruth.
We can only sustain so long one product, one brand, one entrepreneur having the spotlight. And so I would be surprised if a year from now there are still 10,000 tweets a month about the cronut.
Dominique Ansel says he's not interested in mass producing the cronut or jacking up the price. For now, he's still charging the original $5 per cronut and limiting customers to just two. It's Ann Duckett's reward for her two-hour wait.
It's a little on the small side, nice color, the blackberry looks pretty. I'm going to take a bite. Totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Amy Held, NPR News.
This summer is the 150th anniversary of some of the key battles of the Civil War, like Gettysburg, which might inspire a lot of you to brush up on your American history. In which case, you probably don't want to be taking notes from Drunk History. The popular YouTube series has been picked up as a TV show now on Comedy Central, and the first episode aired this week. The show involves a pixelated narrator retelling, usually pretty badly, a true historical event, like Watergate, for example.
Woodward meets with Mark Felt, and he says, "Put the pieces together, you It's all in front of you. Do the work."
While well-known actors play out the narration, lip-syncing the sloshy dialogue, you are left, I want to say, in stitches. Derek Waters is the mastermind behind Drunk History, and he joins me now for an extremely sober and realistic interview about his hilarious series. Derek Waters, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jackie. Thank you very much.
You know,
I'm a little offended that you said in the introduction that the narrators aren't telling it well. They're all real stories, and they're trying as hard as they can, Jackie.
Yeah, well, if they tell it really, really well, I don't know how funny it would be.
Well, that's true.
Hey, but that brings up this whole question, Derek, which is, how on earth did you come up with this idea?
Yeah, well, you probably figured alcohol was involved in the discovery of this, and it was. I was drinking with a very dear friend of mine. We were talking about the great Otis Redding and how young he was when he died in the plane crash. And Jake was telling me this story that Otis Redding knew he was going to die. And before he left that day, he had this long conversation with his wife. And it went something to the extent of, "Now you take care of yourself, baby, because I gotta go." And his wife was like, "I will, Otis. You take care of yourself." He's like, "No, you take care of yourself, baby. Otis has to go." And Jake was having such a hard time trying to tell that story. And the whole time, secretly, I was just picturing Otis Redding looking at Jake and just saying, "Shut up, man. That didn't happen."
Now, some of these people are so passionate about their topics. Let me tell you one of my favorite bits, Mary Dreyer. And Mary is a Puritan woman who showed compassion to prisoners.
"But you'll never hear about it anywhere but here.
Well, no.
She's in an unmarked grave on the Boston Common. And you know whose grave is marked? Jim Morrison. He wrote horrible music."
That's Jen Kirkman. Isn't she great?
Yeah. Well, you know what's so great about it? people take this very seriously? I mean, yes, okay. I mean, over there, you know, six scotches or whatever it is you've plied them with. But nobody is being dismissive, at least the folks you've chosen, of the historical episode they want to tell. It's like, you have to hear this. You have to believe me. Do you get people, though, who say, this is just terrible what you're doing? I mean, you're ruining history and you're getting all these people drunk and sick and silly and everything.
Thank God, no. No one's ever said, you're destroying history. It's been the opposite. My dear history teacher, Mr. Stang, he emailed and said, you're putting history out to more people that need to know about it and putting laughter in there so more people can learn.
We have a clip from your first episode, which tells the story of Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, their famous duel. And Alexander Hamilton is played here by the actor Michael Cera.
Here's the thing about Hamilton. George Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton. George Hamilton is an actor. Alexander Hamilton calls his family. He says, I love you. I'm going to miss you. He calls his parents. He says, I'm going to love you. I'm going to miss you. He says, his girl.
I love Alexander Hamilton on his smartphone. Is it difficult to get well-known actors to perform this with you? I mean, other episodes of this have been Jack Black, Winona Ryder, Adam Scott. How do you get these folks on board?
I think once Michael Cera was in it, you know, Jack Black saw it and likes it and goes, oh, that looks fun.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you have so much in your head when you're thinking about how you're going to deliver a line, you know, how you're going to say it. And so when you're acting in Drunk History, you're actually getting to do more because you don't have to worry about how you're going to deliver a line because it's already done.
How do you pick your narrators?
They're all my friends, but some of them are more well-known, and they've seen what we've done in the past, and they know it's not a show about exploiting someone. It's not a show about, yeah, let's get drunk and talk about history. They're trying as hard as they can to make a history show. It's just happens to be slightly altered.
Well, it has been wonderful bending an elbow with you, and I can't wait to see the next episode, and I'm just sitting here thinking, what do I want to see?
Bless your heart. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Derek Waters, creator of Drunk History, a series now on Comedy Central. In a new work of crime fiction, you still have the detective and his buddy, the mysterious body that turns up at the outset, the crazy bar where the cops and criminals hang out together. Only this time, we're not in Scandinavia or South Florida. We're in Nairobi, beset with political violence, hotel bombings, ethnic warfare. Black Star Nairobi is the second in a series from Makoma Wakgogi. The novel opens with that dead body in a forest and two detectives who arrive to investigate.
As they're looking into that, there's a bomb explosion, and then they realize the two of them are connected. So they end up investigating the murder and the bomb explosion through all sorts of adversarial situations.
Ishmael Fofana is the protagonist of Black Star Nairobi, and his creator is author Makoma Wakgogi, who says the name was a nod to Moby Dick.
So I named him Ishmael because he's on a quest. But he's a Black American detective who hails from Madison, Wisconsin. In Blackstone, Nairobi, you find him now already settled in Kenya, but in the previous book, Nairobi Heat, it's an investigation of a murder that sends him to Kenya. So he's an African-American detective on a quest for identity, and while in Kenya then, his Kenyan counterpart, his name is Odhiambo, for short goes by O. And then there's Madi, the femme fatale of the book, who is a Rwandan survivor of the genocide and also was part of the armed struggle.
It's set in such an eventful time in Kenyan history, 2007, during the Kenyan presidential elections, which led to this really disputed outcome, a lot of violence. Why did you choose this particular time frame?
In this novel, I'm driven by the question of violence. In the post-electoral violence of 2007, it was a sort of intimate violence where it was neighbor against neighbor, people who knew each other. And there are a lot of questions that arose, you know, from the 2007 post-electoral violence and questions of class, the questionable democratic process. So I wanted to have characters, you know, who are running around trying to do their case, you know, but all the while being drawn back, you know, by the power, by the powerful nature of the violence that broke out.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Kenya. You spent a lot of time there. You were born in Evanston, Illinois, but you grew up in Kenya. Your father is the very famous Kenyan writer, Gogi Wadyongo, and you live here now. You teach English at Cornell University. I'd like to ask more about the influence that Kenya has on your writing.
Well, you know, for a very long time, I had difficulty, you know, accepting that I was an American citizen because I grew up in Kenya. My parents are Kenyan. My nationality really is Kenyan. And then I came to the U.S., and at some point I had to realize, wow, I've been in the U.S. now longer than I lived in Kenya. In a way, I do mirror, or maybe Ishmael mirrors, you know, my struggles for identity. You know, and eventually I had to tell myself, who decides a person can have only one identity? I mean, who is the gatekeeper of identity? And I just decided to acknowledge, to live out my multiple identities.
Let me ask you a little bit about this genre and your father. Your father is a very acclaimed novelist in Kenya and elsewhere, of course. Why did you choose a detective novel as your approach to literature?
Yeah, you know, we actually just did an event together in London where he said that I've done something he's never been able to do, which is to write a detective story. And Petals of Blood, you know, he says he meant it to be a detective story.
One of your father's most famous books.
Yeah, which to me I find very funny because, you know, because, well, it doesn't read like a detective novel. But I do have this attraction to the form, because with the form you can do so much. Not only can you tell a very, very entertaining story, but you can explore societal issues. It allows you to look at very, very extreme situations, extreme violence, a society just about to explode in a way that I don't think you can do with realist fiction.
And the other thing is you are also a poet, and Ishmael's girlfriend, Muddy, is a spoken word artist. And after the death of one friend of hers, she does this kind of spontaneous eulogy. Could you read that part, please?
Yeah, sure. Let me tell you a story about a word, one word that is as old as the very earth we walk on, a word that crosses boundaries, that swims underneath the currents of culture, a word that is a language. Let me tell you a story about the word love. When love was born, love was living. This love that was newborn and old. And young love said to older love, or is it the other way around? Love said to love, love is birth, love is living, and love is death. Love is gentle, love is fierce. Love is violent, love is God, and love is the devil. And love forgets more than it remembers. But tonight, this morning that is still a night, love is the vehicle that drove us here. Love is us.
That is so beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. With Muddy, I wanted her to, because she comes from a very, very traumatic past, but she tries to deal with it through words. In Blackstone, Nairobi, there's a question of whether actually words are enough, you know, because she keeps reverting back to violence. Violence is her first language, and then poetry is something that she's trying to learn.
Yeah. So you'll go back to teaching. I just think, though, that this cannot clearly be the end for you. I mean, I'm sure, and I certainly hope, we'll see O and Ishmael and Muddy live again in another book.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried because the way they leave each other at the end of the book, if something has to give. Ishmael is really, I think, to my mind, he's losing it. He has lost a grasp of the idea that he was for justice. You know, he's in a very, very vulnerable place. So I'm not sure exactly what will happen in the third one, but I'm looking forward to the adventure as well.
That's Makoma Wagogi, author of the new book, Black Star Nairobi. Makoma, it's been a terrific pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well. Thank you.
Monarchs, sulfurs, swallowtails. These are common butterflies, but a reminder of the splendor of the natural world. Around the mid-19th century, Americans developed a sweeping passion for butterfly collecting, eager perhaps to move on from the Civil War and driven by Europe's long-standing fascination with the insect. In an extensive book, Butterfly People, An American Encounter with the Beauty of the World, William Leach documents the butterfly movement. His own passion for the jeweled insects began when he was a small boy, growing up in a tightly packed urban environment.
One of the really most delightful things that happened to me as a child is when my father constructed a net for me, made from cheesecloth and an old pole and a hanger. And he gave me very cheaply constructed a cigar box to use to put the butterflies in once I caught them.
It was a turning point for Leach, setting him off on an adventure that's ongoing today. He spent 14 years researching his book, filling it with the stories of pioneering naturalists. Foremost among them is Alfred Russel Wallace. After capturing an unnamed butterfly in 1857, he wrote, "On taking it out of my net and opening the glorious wings, my heart began to beat violently. The blood rushed to my head, and I felt more like fainting than I've done when in apprehension of death. I had a headache the rest of the day."
The heart that pounds is when you encounter something like a butterfly, which is wild and inaccessible, but beautiful. And the quest is everything, to try to get the butterfly. All that time, your heart is racing. And practically every individual in my book experienced this phenomenon.
A racing heart was just the beginning of what entomologist Herman Strecker felt. Strecker collected hundreds of thousands of butterflies and moths, but his career was also stained by controversy when he was accused of stealing museum butterflies under his hat. Born in 1836 in Philadelphia to a German stonecutter, his father tried to beat the hobby out of his son with a leather strap. But Strecker wouldn't be stopped.
He was in the possession of what he and other German-Americans would have called Sehnsucht. Sehnen meaning yearning, and Zuck, or Zucken, it means to excess or to addiction. And he was, like other Americans, experiencing something quite extraordinary for the first time. This diverse, wonderful, rich faunal world around him in America that no one had really ever studied, and no one had the language to study.
Entomologist William Henry Edwards helped write the language of an emerging scientific field. Throughout his career, the grandfather of the butterfly movement identified hundreds of species, tapping into Darwin's Origin of the Species to help guide the study of the butterfly as a living thing and not just a dried-out museum specimen. But this Sehnsucht for butterflies couldn't sustain its fever pitch, and ultimately it burned out. And with the coming of the 20th century, Leach writes, our love for technology and innovation overshadowed the natural world. Increasingly, development has killed off the habitat of the butterflies. Yet Leach is hopeful that in our stressful modern world, our passion for butterflies can be stoked once again.
This tradition allowed for what was virtually the free play of the sensuous impulses of individuals, but not in a way that would have violated Victorian principles, but it got them into the beauty of nature, as nothing else could have. And the old natural tradition, along with collecting, that was so central to it, is no longer what it was, and that is disturbing to me. The question remains, how do you get children to connect to the richness of the natural world?
Perhaps it's as simple as heading outside with a homemade butterfly net and a racing heart. Once again, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and it's time now for music.
Every time I listen to the sound of a baby wailing the night.
That deep, resounding voice belongs to Dawn Gibson. He spells it D-A-U-G-H-N, not like the country singing Don Gibson of the 50s and 60s. This Dawn Gibson held a number of truly odd jobs before his singing career took off, from long-haul trucking to playing drums in a blues metal band to working in a porn shop. More on that later. Gibson became buzzworthy last year with his debut album, All Hell. This song is from his latest, a new record called Me Moan, and both offerings left reviewers fumbling to describe this sound and to place this voice. It lives somewhere between Johnny Cash and Iggy Pop.
I don't even consider myself a singer at all. I always call myself a drummer, and I probably always will. It wasn't up until really last year when I started working on All Hell that I was singing on any recordings at all.
You mean you didn't know you have that fabulous voice? Come on.
I didn't know until I got up to the mic to belch it out. And I was, you know, pleasantly surprised. I found a voice I could sing in that didn't make me cringe later on. So I just continued using that voice and appropriating different background music for the voice.
How do you describe your music, or what's your favorite description of your music?
I guess there's no easy way to do it. Generally, I just say it's country techno, and then whoever I tell that to rolls their eyes and walks away. So now I've kind of just been saying, well, I just do country music.
It was a quiet afternoon, talking with my drink at Rio Bar and Grill.
You know, I'm really attracted to the story that is a true story from your life, and this is you get your trucking license. You're 22 years old. You're doing these long-haul jobs, really a lonely job.
Well, I mean, when you're driving long stretches like that, you tend to wax nostalgic a lot. And even at the age of 22, I remember just thinking about old days and old loves and old embarrassments. It's enough to drive you completely insane. But I did make certain discoveries along the way, and I guess an appreciation of matching music with landscapes or matching music with certain scenes and listening to people that you meet at bars or you know, truck stops. It gives you a greater sense of empathy, and for me, it seemed like it defined my palate a little bit more, and not necessarily musically, just in terms of how to approach things creatively altogether.
What took me down something long is one shot. So high, you left me in the parking lot. Ooh, kissing on the blacktop.
This wasn't the only really interesting job that you had, Dawn Gibson. You also worked, I think, in a dirty bookstore, right? I mean, I love the story of how you were asked to keep an eye on the customers.
Yeah. That was also a job for, you know, I was about 20 years old. And a friend of mine had just gotten fired from it, which, you know, it takes a lot to get fired from an adult bookstore. I'm not quite sure what he did. So I took the job, and every night it was me and, you know, five other derelicts behind the counter, not really doing anything, just listening to rap music and watching the security monitors to make sure no one was in the back, you know, doing anything wrong.
Even though they're encouraged to come in there to do things wrong.
Basically, yeah, we're giving them carte blanche to explore all their carnal desires in these back rooms. But when they cross the line, and it's a very thin line, we have to go back and scold them.
A lot of these songs are raw. I mean, they are speaking from the heart, but they're also, you know, at that edge where what we might call polite society just wouldn't want to go or drift into. A lot of bad behavior, a lot of really bad behavior. I'm thinking about a song, I was marveling to read that it's based on a true story, and this is a song you call The Pisgie Nest. Tell me the tale behind that one, would you please?
Well, yeah, somewhere in central Pennsylvania, I was driving around with a buddy of mine and someone who's from there, and we were in a mountain area, and we passed by a village called the Pisgie Nest. It's more or less, you know, what someone in West Virginia or Kentucky would call a holler. This was just kind of a dilapidated mountain village. And really, he just said, this is a place where the state trooper's daughter would go to engage in kind of extreme sexual behavior. And I was really disturbed by it, only because the setting, it was dark out, we were driving around at night.
We broke in a court account around, but you had to go back for your lucky red. State trooper's daughter in the Pisgie Nest, and I'll never know where the wind took my hat, no.
And I think I read in the account of this, she was actually engaging in prostitution. I mean, that her boyfriend was sort of pimping her out.
Well, yeah, that was actually an embellishment, because really the story was so bare that I didn't have much to go on. I think I'm generally moved by obscene things. You know, I'm a fan of B-movies. I'm a fan of trauma. I'm a fan of dirty books. Sometimes I find something can be moving and artistic and obscene all at once. I don't want to do it too much or be over the top, but that was a memory of mine, or just hearing the story activated my imagination. So more or less, I just elaborated on that one sentence.
When you think about the lyrics you write, the stories you want to tell, Are you drawn to what might be called, and this does make me think so much about country, the broken places?
Oh, for sure, yeah. Country music resonates with me for that reason. It is the only genre of music that actually makes me fully cry. So when I go into that writing words, I'm not thinking about, you know, metaphors or abstractions. I want to be as hyper-literal as I can and make there a clear understanding of what's happening in this particular scene.
If you're still unsure, turn on.
That's Don Gibson. His new album is called Me Moan. You can hear a few tracks on our website at nprmusic.org. Don Gibson, it was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise, Jackie. Thank you.
For the week ending July 14th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Elliot Hannon, Rachel Rood, and Rima Kreis. Our intern is Jan Stewart. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor and Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thank you for listening.